The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show. The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Get your copy of the Africa Financial Markets Index report at cib.absa.africa and explore Africa's possibility in detail. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Well, Caleb Kassim is standing by, the Eskom Chief Financial Officer. Terrible results out of Eskom today. We'll pick up on those in a moment. I'll tell you why it's not all doom and gloom, at least for some. Plus, this evening, we will chat to Rob Rose. Rob is the editor of the Financial Mail, and Brandon Topham, who's executive for investigations and enforcement at the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, the highest ever fine for insider trading imposed on a single individual. And a couple of friends who were tipped off when Marcus Juste knew that all was going pear-shaped at Steinhoff. That's all coming up on The Money Show. We'll play the Brutal Biz quiz. We'll bring you the best bits between 7 and 8 and a fabulous artisan for you in our Friday file at 20 to 7.
702. SMS Bruce.
On 31702.
Weak results from Eskom, another 20 billion rand loss for the most recent financial year. Caleb Kassim is the Chief Financial Officer at Eskom. These are the results, Caleb, to the end of March. So, I mean, by that time, André de Ruyter, the new chief executive, the new management team had been, I suppose, in office for, what, 3 months? It's safe to say these aren't the results of the current management team.
Well, I think, Bruce, first, thanks for having me on. At the end of the day, it was just under one quarter. But you will recall when we presented March 2019, we did indicate it's going to remain tough for at least the next two financial years. And that's what's reflected in the results. However, there are some positive signs, as we indicated today, that we are getting a handle on our operating costs, where we kept it relatively flat on OPEX and employee staff costs, and our CAPEX has been reduced. So there are some positive signs in getting a handle of on our cost base.
Well, I mean, you get a handle on the cost base, it's still too high. You pay too much for coal and you pay too much in wages, simply put.
So, yeah, I think on the coal, Bruce, you know, that has been a challenge. It's some legacy contracts that are co-filtering through in the system. Back in 2018, when we were desperate to secure coal to increase our stockpiles and reduce the impact on the economy in terms of load shedding. Well, we are seeing that in this financial year, as indicated, that escalation in coal costs will reduce. But, there's always room for improvement, especially on the coal side. You know, we need to migrate away from road transport back to coal mines from the mine mouth straight to the power station. That eliminates a significant component of the coal cost.
And then I mean, the destruction of roads, for example, around Lydenburg. I was shown some video footage of a friend who'd been in the Lydenburg area fairly recently, and they were just showing the heavy coal trucks going, thundering down these roads where people have to pull off the road to avoid the potholes and each other. It's a disaster zone, isn't it?
Yeah, I think other than the cost, it's a serious safety hazard. And the quicker we can fulfill our strategy of increasing either direct conveyor belts, and secondly, we want to increase the level of rail transport, working in conjunction with Transnet to do that.
Key to your recovery is going to be whether or not you can get rid of nearly, 60% of your debt, which is sitting close enough to half a trillion rand, to call it half a trillion rand. It's like a game. I don't know when last you went to a kid's birthday party, but they play a game called Pass the Parcel. And you pass it round and round and round, and in the middle there's something nice, like a piece of chocolate or a nice little present. But instead of this Eskom Pass the Parcel, there's a rotting fish head on the inside. And I can't imagine anybody wants to play Pass the Parcel with you. How are you going to convince government to take on some of your debt when government's got its own problems?
Yeah, I think I did indicate, a mirror image to the sovereign. But we all understand, the more, the sooner we deal with that debt, Bruce, I think if you look at the positive, it will then allow government and we will relieve the need on bailouts. You know, 50 billion rand per annum is significant. So getting through this combination of our cost efficiency drive, making sure that we collect what is due to us, there is a migration to higher tariffs to cover our cost of capital. You know, government can do a lot with 50 billion that's coming to Eskom. So I think that's the benefit. Bottom line is, if you look at the debt service cost, by them giving us the 50 billion, they effectively, our understanding, are servicing a huge chunk of that debt. So we need to make the tough decisions. But the minister has indicated we are working with National Treasury and DPE in particular on this item.
We hope it happens quickly, Khalib Kasim. You and I are paying too much for the electricity that you generate. And of course, on top of the, what, 1 rand 20 per kilowatt hour that I think Eskom charges, I think that's the price they charge, most municipalities then add another 100% on top of, well, yeah, 50 to 100% on top of that. I look at the price I pay in my area by my municipality for the power they get from Eskom, and they add a hefty chunk, a hefty, hefty chunk. It's another tax, of course. On your earnings. Let's catch up on another good story on the day. Well, a good story on the day, and that's a huge fine that has been lumped on Marcus Huerster and people he tipped off about the impending implosion of Steinhoff. The Divisional Executive for Investigations and Enforcement at the Financial Sector Conduct Authority is Brandon Topham on the line to us from Tshwane this evening. This is a record fine, Brandon, for South Africa. Marcus Huerster bearing the brunt of the fine, which is over 200 million rand. He's expected to pay 161.6 million rand, which is three times more than the losses he avoided by trading in shares when he had insider information, correct?
Well, Bruce, he didn't trade in shares at all. So that's a fine for sending an SMS to people that
okay.
sell your shares.
So all right, so he didn't act... He gave advice to other people, but didn't act on that advice himself. And so this is, you know, he sent, what, three or four SMSs. These must be the most expensive SMSs in history.
Yeah, very expensive SMS, I say. Definitely.
So what justifies the quantum of the fine of 161.6 million rand for warning others to sell?
Well, I think that if people realize that if you just send an SMS, you can get a fine. Or if you trade a small amount of money, we will still come after you. As you saw, one of the fines only 18,000 rand. And in another case of a fine of 150 million rand, the person's actually passed away. So his estate and the company which he traded through is responsible for that money. And the fine was calculated on how much we conservatively estimated at the time that they traded, they avoided losing. Bearing in mind, if we calculated a week or a month later, that fine would have been theoretically a lot higher. So we use a more conservative approach, trying to act as possible to everybody.
How do you enforce these fines? I mean, what legal resources do you have at your disposal to enforce the fines? Because I would assume that those whom you are fining will be making a beeline for the courts if they haven't already.
Well, they have the right to appeal to our tribunal, and part of that right to appeal, they can actually make an application for the tribunal to halt the need for them to pay the fine, because they've got 30 days to pay it or 30 days in which to come up with payment arrangements with us, unless the tribunal says, no, you can hold off until we've heard your matter. And then thereafter, they don't pay it. Obviously, we do bear charge interest in anything in terms of our act. We can file a statement with the court and we get a civil judgment effectively and go through the normal process of executing a civil debt.
So there is a disincentive for delays because, I mean, when you've got large financial resources, if you are Marcus Huerster, one assumes he has a piggy bank or two stashed somewhere, he may very well be able to tie you up in the courts for years. However, the consequence there is interest on 161.6 million rand will compound fairly quickly.
That's correct. And we do anticipate that some of the persons who have been levied with administrative penalty will probably appeal. We have done thorough work and we've consulted widely with experts in the field to ensure that our interpretation of the various sections and our calculations are correct. And we're quite happy to go to court to support our decision in this regard.
Brandon Topham is Divisional Executive for Investigations and Enforcement at the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. The man who wrote the book on Steinhoff is Rob Rose, the editor of the Financial Mail, on the line to us from Johannesburg. It's a big fine, Rob Rose. Do we know the whereabouts of Marcus Uister and whether or not he has any intention of paying it?
Evening, Bruce. As far as I know, Marcus is down somewhere between Hermanus and Stellenbosch. But as for his intentions of paying it, I mean, who's to say? I mean, he basically objected to the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. He said that he disputed what they said. He said it was unconstitutional of them to carry out the procedure, the investigation the way they did. So I think it's a fairly safe bet to imagine he will certainly resist this fine and possibly even take it as far as the Constitutional Court.
And I've got a WhatsApp from a friend of mine earlier today, full of quite rude language, saying, how is this, and then I'll substitute a word, person not in jail? He took the JSE down with him. He left people destitute, and he just gets to be a little less rich from his slush fund in the Cayman Islands, perhaps. I feel like going full Karen on his ass, says my correspondent, because that's what the world needs right now, another righteously indignant middle-aged white lady. So many people are so furious at Marcus Uister, who is yet to face the full might of the law, and there's a great deal of unhappiness in the political spectrum, in business circles, in civil society, at the slow pace of justice in this particular case. This is the first really significant move we've seen by the authorities, saying that Marcus Uister is guilty of an infringement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Bruce, it's taken forever. It's taken 3 years. And if you compare it to, the Wirecard scandal, which happened sort of middle of this year, I suppose, a couple of months ago. I mean, the guy was...
Wirecard was in South Korea, correct?
Absolutely. So, I mean, there's really a degree of frustration that I think is completely justified. This is 3 years after it happened. But the good thing is that, the insider trading case that they concluded today, it's a fairly straightforward case. I mean, Marcus sent an SMS saying, you've always asked when things are going bad that I should tell you, and I'm telling you now it might be good to ditch your shares. I mean, as far as insider trading goes, it would seem to be a fairly open and shut case. So you'd think that the National Prosecuting Authority will now take this and do something with it. Because, I mean, sure, the massive fraud, the 106 billion rand fraud, whatever, that's a lot larger and a lot more complicated. But this side of the criminal investigation will probably be a lot easier to conclude. But you're totally right. There's an immense frustration. Most people were touched by Steinhoff. We had lots of people had, their pension funds were invested in. So it's had a massive impact on the wider society, and there's been zero accountability for it.
This is the first step, and probably many steps, to try and hold Marcus Uister accountable. One anticipates that Marcus Uister is going to fight this with every resource that he has at his disposal, and we assume that he still has plenty of resources.
Yeah, we assume that. We don't know for sure. I mean, his personal holdings were always fairly opaque, and there was family trusts, and there was Mayfair speculators and various entities. Someone like Marcus Uister never operated in a very straightforward way, so it's difficult to get a sense of exactly what his personal assets are at the moment. But certainly the way he's conducted his hearing in Parliament about 2 years ago, and then this particular case where he alleged unconstitutionality and various objections that he raised, indicates that he certainly will fight it, as I think he will any criminal action that comes against him. He will take the Stalingrad approach.
Well, he has so much to lose in this particular case as he bears the brunt of this very significant fine. I mean, it's a very strong signal from the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. I mean, whether he pays the fine or not, or fights the fine or not, it's a very strong signal that they will use every bit of regulation and legislation at their disposal to catch out wrongdoers. It's the strongest signal I think we've seen from them so far.
Yeah, I actually think it's great. I mean, when you heard Brandon speaking now, it's something like four times what the previous record was, and that was Deutsche Bank for insider trading in South Africa, the Deutsche Bank case. And for a case for Marcus Uister to then be hit with a fine that is four times that, or even more, when he didn't even make any money off the sale, he just took people off and went to sell their shares, is an indication of just how seriously they're taking it. And I think it's a massive... sign in our markets that people should be wary of doing this kind of thing.
Rob Rose, thank you. The editor of the Financial Mail.
The Money Show. The Markets.
To Nick Kunze this evening, portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. I mean, they can fine Marcus Joost as much as they like. They can get the insider traders. They can throw people in jail. They can prosecute the fraud. It doesn't mean that Steinhoff is worth anything, Nick Kunze. The damage is done.
Yeah, Bruce, good evening. Yeah, damage is done. I listened to your intro with Rob there now. I'm afraid the damage is done, and Steinhoff now being very much a penny share. I think most people who still hold it, it's one of those ones you put in the bottom drawer, and if it goes up, it goes up. But I think most people have basically put that aside. But I think just listening to that intro, Bruce, I mean, I think people do want to start seeing someone like Mr. Yester in jail, quite frankly.
Yeah, a little bit of retribution goes a long way. Mm. One company that is worth a lot of money, well, two companies that are worth a lot of money. One is called Prosus and one is called Naspers. And they were at the center of absolutely everything today because Prosus saying that it intends to buy $5 billion, that's a lot of money, $5 billion in total of Naspers and Prosus shares in the open market. What's the logic of a company the size of Prosus buying shares in itself and in its former parent?
This was quite a fascinating one. It dominated our sort of our morning chats in the office today. I think there's a couple of reasons. Firstly, everyone knows they've been grappling. Anyone who's been looking at Naspers has realized it trades a significant discount to that 10 cent they call the rump in financial terms, or the stub, also known as. And now, as of yesterday, I looked at the Bruce, it's about 58% discount. It's the widest it's ever been in history. Yeah, if you strip it out, it's extraordinary, that gap. And it just goes to show that all intents and purposes, you know, they had good intentions to list on in Amsterdam. Half the idea was to try and close that gap. And it just hasn't worked. And I actually don't think it's a bad do, actually. I mean, if there's frothy, elevated share prices and tech shares, and, you know, they are sitting with a cash pile after the recent sales, burning a hole in their pocket, or rather run off and buy something. They try to buy the food delivery business. Another way of maybe realizing value is to buy back their own shares. So I actually think it was quite a shrewd move, quite frankly. But obviously, you know, time will tell. I mean, if 10 cents sells off, Naspers is going to sell off as well. But at the moment, I think more positive than negative, Bruce.
One of my colleagues was saying, you know, it sounds very arrogant when you say, you know, there's nothing else worth buying. We're the best thing on the market. And I said to him, well, it's a bit like voting for yourself in a beauty contest, isn't it? I mean, that's essentially what Prosus is doing.
Yeah, I'd actually never thought of it that way. That is quite true. Basically saying no one is as good as us, so we'll spend money on ourselves, yeah. But no, I really think if the number crunches and the spreadsheet people out there, we'll also realize that this gap is massive. And I, quite frankly, it's probably the best use of capital for now. I mean, if you're going to look around, there's not many bargains to be had. Although saying that, looking at the U.S. tech shares the last few days, they might want to keep a little bit of powder dry for next week, actually.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a huge sell-off, and that sell-off has continued in the United States today. It's been a big sell-off in Europe this week. It's had a big impact also on the JSE, and a lot of people would have listened to the medium-term budget policy statement or looked at the headlines and gone, oh, my goodness me, my shares were worth X on Monday, they were worth Z on Friday afternoon. It's all because the country's falling apart, and we're going to go bankrupt, and the government has got no control of the spending, and it's a disaster zone, which may or may not be true, but this week's market activity is all really about what's happening in the rest of the world.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, take your blinkers off if you're a JSE investor. You know, it's not just about the JSE. In fact, yesterday, the massive move yesterday, we were a relative outperformer. I think JSE compared to some of the European markets down 4 or 5%. I mean, we haven't seen that for a while. But yes, you're entirely right. The lockdown's happening. The sell-off in the tech space today. We had the big techs reporting last night, all the fangs, Amazon and Apple. Twitter's down, I think, 20% as we speak. So
Apple really got smashed as well, didn't it? Apple got nailed.
And Apple, as rightly said, being the biggest tech company of all, too. So, you know, people be careful what they wish for. I mean, these fangs have dragged these markets up, and they've obviously printing cash and COVID and lockdown. But I think I got spooked with SAP last week, or the start of this week. I think days moving so quick, I forget when it was, that realized that under COVID, that it's not necessarily a license to print cash for these tech companies. And we're seeing a bit of a sell-off. And, of course, don't forget the lockdown that's happening in Europe. I saw a headline today, Bruce, European Banking Index at the same level it was in 1987, 33 years ago. So, I mean, some frightening stats going around at the moment.
It's hardly surprising then that our banks and insurers have sold off. I mean, you may make the assumption that South Africa's sovereignty, financial sovereignty is at risk, and therefore banks and insurers are getting nailed. But when the world's banks are seeing their valuations smashed, it's hardly surprising that domestic banks sort of fall in the wake of that.
Yeah, exactly. Look, I'm in a little bit of a different spot. I mean, our cost of borrowing, as you know, is in a very different space to Europe at a negative. So we are in a slightly different space. But you're right. I mean, financials around the world are under pressure. And financials are always that sort of leading indicator. You know, when markets go up and the banks lend money and they lend on credit and the economy turns, they tend to move higher. And that's the space. It fills me with dread when I saw that stat today with the European banks and also JP Morgan also down about 15% just this week. So South African banks, they're also triggering along sideways. They had a big pop on Friday, if you remember, and we're pretty much back to where we were on Friday, unfortunately.
Moody's today saying it's unimpressed with the lack of detail around implementation plans for South Africa's great big plan to take us back from the brink. They didn't like the medium-term budget policy statement. But despite all of that, our currency is behaving in mysterious ways. We're kind of where we were on Monday.
It is a strange one. And look, I saw the often medium-term budget. It was the bond yield sort of poked out 7, 8, 9 bips, and I thought that's kind of a reflection of hearing that dreaded SAA word again. But the rand was only down about 0.7 or 0.8% on the Wednesday. It was a bit firmer yesterday, and then today as well. So look, I don't know if it's a bit of a carry trade. People like our yield. I mean, also the mess that's happening in Turkey. You can't even trade the Turkish lira. Apparently, there's exchange controls that implemented on that. So maybe this rand is a proxy of risk, but I'd have it going the other way today. So I don't know. I mean, maybe someone can WhatsApp you if they've got an answer, because I certainly don't understand it.
Well, and then we'll make them market commentator in the future. Nick Kunze, thank you very much indeed. It's a big and complicated, crazy and completely unpredictable world. Nick Kunze, portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, wrapping it all up for us. Thank you very much. I mean, if you're feeling a bit gloomy this evening with all of the news that is around us all the time, it may be useful to remember that not everybody is feeling miserable. It's quite an astonishing statistic from the Reserve Bank, which publishes every week a chart of the week. This week's chart of the week shows the number of mortgages granted in September this year compared to September last year. And it's a massive increase. September last year, 21,500 mortgages, roughly, were granted in September. This year, it's nearly 31,000, nearly 50% more mortgages granted in September this year than September last year. It's at decade highs, and the Reserve Bank, I think, rightly points out that we've got the lowest prime rate in 55 years, and so buying a home is becoming more affordable than renting. So it's nice to see that, you know, 30,729 people in September took on a mortgage. Buying a house, a roof over their heads, betting on the long term. Nice to see.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Get your copy of the Africa Financial Markets Index Report at cib.absa.africa and explore Africa's possibility in detail. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
I do like the Friday file because it gives me time to go on to come to artisans' websites and to really creative individuals' websites and trawl and dream and drool and look at the great work that they're doing. And there's just so much really wonderful stuff going on in South Africa in this artisanal space. Adam Young is the owner of Rowdy Bags. I must confess, I hadn't heard of Rowdy Bags until today. And we'll talk to Adam Young in just a couple of minutes' time, because I think it's important that we catch up with him. On the next Money Show, Bafana Bafana former defender Matthew Booth talking to us all about things money in other people's money, and our special feature. Also, our business books feature. We're talking to Carl Kemp, brand new book, Promised Land, Exploring South Africa's Land Conflict, a critical read. That and all the other big money stories for the week and the week ahead, next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
Adam Young is with us, the owner of Rowdy Bags. You didn't start this business, Adam Young. I think you bought it, about 2 or 3 years ago?
That's right. Yeah, the business was started in 2012 by a friend of mine, and I started working with him in, I think it was 2016, and bought it in 2018.
We hear stories about people who, you know, they buy a product or they work in a company and they like it so much, they buy the business. What was it that attracted you to this leather work business? I mean, it's beautiful range of soft looking bags and leather accessories.
I think it was really the sort of spirit of the company. I mean, I just loved going there. I loved walking into the factory every day. It's got a very special and exciting feeling every time you walk inside. So it was that as much as the product that attracted me to the business, and not to mention, I think the way forward was quite clear. You know, there seemed to be a very exciting sort of future for the business. So it was the whole package.
And absolutely, I mean, there's also nothing quite like the smell of new leather. It's that absolutely. New car smell, and I'm sure when you go into your factory, that's what you smell. You source the leather, and I find this really interesting, from Namibia, and you call it African organic leather. What is it about the leather that you get there that you can't find here?
It's really about we like the story behind the cows, in Namibia. It's illegal to put antibiotics in the meat, and it's also illegal to give them growth hormones. So we're looking at very happy cows that they've got their scratches still on the skins, which, you know, those scratches end up on your bag. You know, these really natural, beautiful scratches. We don't like to hide those things, but rather celebrate them. We just like the fact that there's, you know, it's just a bit of there's a bit more to a Namibian cow, and it's not so it's not such a sad story behind it.
So, I mean, it doesn't affect the quality, the grade of the leather necessarily, but it's an ethical point of view as to from your the source of the product. You like the way the farming operations are happening there relative to what you're seeing in South Africa at the sort of scale that you need to acquire leather. I'm sure there's some very good organic farmers in South Africa who might not quite have the volumes you need.
Well, absolutely. I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's exactly that. It doesn't affect the grade of the leather. As I said, I mean, all cows go and give themselves a scratch if they go, you know, eat some grass under a fence or something like that. We just like to keep that scratch on the bag where other suppliers might, other bag manufacturers might cut around it.
I heard the name Rowdy Bags, and I was expecting more of Gianni Versace than Giorgio Armani, but your styles aren't rowdy. I mean, they are very elegant, they're timeless, they're classic. They're sort of quite, you know, they sort of look like they emulate some of the more conservative designer elements of handbag manufacturers around the world, or bag manufacturers broadly.
Yeah, our designs have always been very simple. We've always, you know, adopted a philosophy of simplicity with our product. And that being said, we are designing a new range at the moment. Our product, our styles haven't really been updated for about 3 years. And I've brought on a product designer, a full-time product designer in the last year. So what we're looking at is a new product range, which sort of it certainly pays its dues to the old product range, but we would like to start to get a little bit more rowdy in our designs. Thanks for bringing that up.
it's not a criticism, it's just the name and the brand, they don't seem to match. But see also you'll do personalizations, and Dele Graaf, for example, which is very, very top end, their brand on your brand, on your bags, and so that's kind of a really nice it's a really nice endorsement then of the quality they prepare to add their very, very top end brand to your products as well, which I think then underpins quite a strong brand ethos.
Yeah, we get approached by a lot of corporates who are looking for that sort of thing. It does speak to the quality of our brand, our bags, which is you know, wonderful. So, you know, very humbling. I'm always quite excited to work with corporates because, you know, it's great work.
And also, when I look at your marketing, and it's sort of, you've got the Tokai Plantation tree shots in Cape Town. I think that's where you shot, maybe the Newlands Forest and the Pine Forest there. Very, very nice and natural. But also on Westminster Bridge, for example. Clearly, the global ambition is there, and it's very strong.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. We didn't really export any bags at the beginning of the year, and now I would say most of our business is export. So what we've done is, with our marketing, we approach influencers who are traveling around the world, and we work with, if we've got one of our partners heading to the UK or to the US or Morocco or something like that, they take some of the bags along and get us the content in these countries. And that also speaks to the spirit of Rowdy, which, you know, Rowdy is a traveler and a globetrotter. So, that's the general sort of thinking behind those shots.
It's quite courageous taking leather goods to Morocco. I mean, I don't know if you've been to the leather works in Fez, for example, where it's fragrant, I'll give you that. But I mean, they're notorious for making, you know, beautiful sheepskin slippers and all sorts of stuff. But when you're looking at export markets, you say you hadn't sold much globally at the beginning of this year. Lockdowns happened. You've got a great online portal. You're getting traction clearly through the internet.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think our marketing and our e-commerce and basically also being at the biscuit mill market in Cape Town has been a great way to meet a lot of the right people. And we've been approached by distributors, and as I said at the beginning of the year, we weren't doing any export, and now that is sort of the bulk of our business. So we were just very lucky to have been able to go in that direction in a year like this.
Do you find being at a place like a neighbor goods market, which is, you know, lovely and top end, that you get lots of buyers coming through looking for new ideas from all over the place?
I wouldn't say people are buyers that are out there, you know, looking for the products to take to the new country. But I think when people see these South African products, these South African artisans, they just get so excited, and everyone's got ideas about what they would like to do. And, you know, every so often one of them turns out to be a good one. So, that's been my experience of these tourists who come down, is that, you know, they've all got something going in their own country. And, you know, sometimes they're interested in what they see and when they travel.
They become your ambassadors. Adam Young, thank you.
Absolutely.
The owner of Rowdy Bags, based in Cape Town, but online.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Get your copy of the Africa Financial Markets Index Report at cib.absa.africa and explore Africa's possibility in detail. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
Sorry about the rude interruption, Anisha. You're absolutely right. First answer under your belt. The Lyft business is an airline business. Sticking in that part of the world of industry, Heathrow Airport was once the busiest airport in Europe. It no longer is. Which is now the busiest airport in Europe?
Oh, I'd have to guess, Bruce.
Pick a city. Pick a pretty city. Pick a city where you might be happy to be in love. I don't know, Anisha.
Paris.
You think so? Are you not in Frankfurt or Stuttgart or somewhere more austere? Absolutely right. Paris. Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris. Heathrow's lost its place as the busiest airport in Europe. Now, there's a Borat slogan. And Kazakhstan, which was really grumpy with Borat 10, 15 years ago when the first movie came out, has now decided if you can't beat him, join him. And they've decided to use one of his little sayings in a new marketing campaign. What is that Borat saying that Kazakhstan has adopted?
Unfortunately, that one you've got me.
Okay, I can't give you another clue, Anisha, because I was far too nice to you earlier. William in Brakpan, I don't know if you're a Borat fan, but which Borat slogan is Kazakhstan embracing?
Not sure, Bruce. Sorry.
Oh, William in Brakpan, you need to watch more Borat. Mike in Santon, are you going to have a go at Borat and the slogan?
Bruce, I only know the bad one about his sister.
No, not that one, Mike. No, it's not appropriate. And Kazakhstan would not use that one. But Borat is, so I'm not going to, if you're not going to answer it, and I'm at risk of you saying the bad one, or one of the many bad ones, then I've got to gong you out, I'm afraid, Mike. So what is the Borat slogan? The Borat slogan, which is used by Kazakhstan, and it's worked very well. Andy Rice and I discussed it
on Tuesday evening in Andy's Heroes and Zeros. And Andy made Kazakhstan the hero on Tuesday. Justin? Justin? Justin's not there. Let's try Justin one more time. See if we can get him just in time. Justin? That's not nice, Justin. Not nice. Maybe Faisal in Edenvale can help us out. Oh, Faisal, radio off and answer, please.
It's nice.
Pardon?
It's nice.
Ooh, close, Faisal, but no cigar. This is the brutal biz quiz. This isn't the nice biz quiz. You've got to be absolutely spot on, I'm afraid. Rina?
Yes?
The answer is?
Are you still asking the one about Borax?
See, yes, I am.
Very nice.
Very nice, and not a bad accent. I'll give it to you, Rina. I'll give it to you. Very nice, indeed. Here's my favorite question of the day. It's very nerdy. Chris Stoltz, Jill Marcus, Tito Mboweni, and the de Kock father and son duo at different times all had the same job. What job was that?
Finance minister?
No, you've fallen for the trick, Rina. I'm afraid not. Tracy and Claremont, Chris Stoltz, Jill Marcus, Tito Mboweni. Yeah.
Yes, Reserve Bank Governor.
Absolutely right. Jill Marcus was Deputy Finance Minister at one point. Then she became Deputy to Tito Mboweni. Then Tito left and she took over. Tito had taken over from Chris Stoltz. And in decades before that, there was a father and son duo who at different times also were governors. Dr. Michiel de Kock was governor from 1945 to 1962, and his son Gerard between 1981 and 1989, a dreadful decade for interest rates. SA Airlink, Tracy, has changed its name to what?
SA Airlink?
Yes, it's changed its name. It's dropped part and kept one part, and it's now called? It just it's had two parts to its name. It's dropped one part. And there's one part left.
What about Airlink?
Tracy, you are... you must be psychic. You can read my mind. You can read my mind. Oh, what you've got to do to get a whiz of the biz quiz on a Friday. I think we should do the biz quiz on a Monday when people are far more alert. But well done to you, Tracy. You got it eventually. That is absolutely correct. You are the whiz of the biz quiz. Coming up after Eyewitness News, best bits of the money show from the week that has been. Don't go away. Stay tuned, please, for this evening and for the weekend. Fabulous music all weekend, of course, as well.
And now,
the money show
with Bruce Whitfield.
Live, online, DSTV,
92.7 and 106 FM.
702.
Let's walk the talk.
Well, on to the second hour of The Money Show on this Friday night, and welcome to the best bits of The Money Show, a digest of just some of the best interviews from the show this week. If you'd like to hear more, you can go to our website or your favourite podcast app and search for The Money Show. Do give us a decent rating. It pushes us up the charts and more people get to hear The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. This week, we saw the Finance Minister, Tito Mboweni, do the impossible, and that is to try and balance South Africa's books, tabling his mid-term budget policy statement, and surprise, surprise, found 10.5 billion rand to help keep SAA flying into the future. It's not a bailout, he said. It's just for the business rescue process for a new airline. No contradictions there. Bad news out of African Bank announcing that it has started with retrenchments. Hardly surprising considering the state of the economy, which the finance minister said this week would contract by at least 7.8%. The president put himself into quarantine, self-quarantining, quashing rumours of a second lockdown. President Ramaphosa testing negative for COVID-19, but did have dinner with somebody who later tested positive and taking no chances in terms of concerns around a second wave of coronavirus, which is leading to lockdowns across Europe and big outbreaks in places like the United States. Well, tonight, we bring you a mix of stories from the world of money, from the week that has been. And one of my favourite stories from this week, amidst all the doom and gloom,
comes out of Stellenbosch, Checkers, and Farmer Angus, who farms on the Spear Wine Estate, have partnered to help young employees buy 85% of Angus McIntosh's egg farming business. And those eggs are going to be supplied into two Western Cape stores with plans to do a whole lot more. We caught up with Angus McIntosh to tell us how the deal was done.
Yeah, so we sold 85% of our egg business to our staff. Unlike the traditional empowerment deals, we didn't go to the bank. I, in effect, vendor financed it. So most of the profits need to pay back the loan, which the new company has got with me. And it's also forced me to stay involved in the business. Because I think a lot of the history of why empowerment deals fail, certainly in agriculture, is a lot of the previous owners walk away. We've kept the brand. We've remodeled it a little bit. And we're super excited about this collaboration with Checkers because, you know, it's really big retail's is in a unique position can push what we call regenerative agriculture. Because, you know, most agriculture is a very destructive act on the land, whereas ours is very much a healing operation. And with big retail, we can really make this a more national thing.
You've been focusing extensively on this regenerative regenerative agriculture. Sorry, I need a drink after today. You call your eggs beyond free range, which I love. And the fact is that these chickens roam along the farm and they spread their manure on the land. And that land then is, of course, regenerated naturally in that way.
Yeah.
And you're going to be supplying eggs to Constantia and Stellenbosch, just two stores within the massive Checkers network. I mean, is this a scalable operation, or is it always going to stay small?
Oh, no, it's completely scalable, and the Checkers guys have been amazing. You know, I was very nervous talking to big retail. They've got this reputation of being incredibly tough. I've had just really pleasant experiences. Payment terms have been excellent, and they have been the guys who said, listen, start with two stores. We've built actually mini eggmobiles. I don't know if you've seen any photographs of them, but they've like these mini egg caravans. So you actually take your own eggs out of the caravan, and it's got a looping video about the egg story, very nicely edited. And so they said to us, just start with two stores, see how they go. We then roll them out to the higher LSM stores around the Western Cape and progress that way. We're going to be doing charcuterie with them very soon. What makes our charcuterie unique is we're the only guys not adding nitrites to it. But that's going to be a quick national rollout because it's an easier thing to transport, and the eggs are very difficult to move around.
But I mean, it's a really exciting deal. I mean, you've been farming on Spear since 2009. Do you lease the land from the Eindhovens? I mean, what is that arrangement?
Yeah. I lease the land. They've put in almost half the capital. Blew up all my Goldman Sachs savings and put my Goldman pension into the farm, and we co-brand a lot of the product. You know, they've been amazing landlords actually.
But this does feel like you're about to do something quite dramatic in terms of spreading the Farmer Angus brand, because anybody who's been to Spear and been to the farm shop at Spear or seen online that you can buy the products and the meat and the chicken and the pork products as well, I mean, it's all there. But to take it national is a very significant leap.
Yeah, it's very significant. I mean, my colleagues are so excited. You know, they walked into the Checkers Stellenbosch store. I took them there this evening, and there's the eggmobile with their video on and taking their photographs, and it's awesome. Now I'm trying to explain the concept of dividend.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Get your copy of the Africa Financial Markets Index Report at cib.absa.africa and explore Africa's possibility in detail. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
That's Farmer Angus, also known as Angus McIntosh, taking his dividends from Goldman Sachs and putting them into South African farming. Well, our consumer ninja Wendy Nola's had a good week, and what a cracker she had this week as she helped somebody get back some money from an insurance company. What happens if you miss a payment on your car insurance? What are your rights in that case, and what are your responsibilities in that case as well, particularly when you fall on hard times through no fault of your own? Let's pick that story up with Wendy Nola.
this year is a very extraordinary year, as we all know, and a lot of the insurers made special plans of various forms with their policyholders to, you know, allow them to skip a couple of payments and things like that. But generally what applies to missing premium payments is the policyholder protection rules, and it's which all the insurers have to abide by. And it's this came into effect in January 2019, and that is insurers must give their policyholders written notice that they haven't received the premium within 15 days of them becoming aware of the non-payment. And from the second month of the policy being taken out, they are required to give clients the benefit of a grace period of at least 15 days after the due date in which to make payment, during which time the policy does not lapse, so that if you have a prang, as you said, you know, you will get paid out, right?
So does this give you, just to get the maths right on this, I miss my payment, say, on the 1st, for the 1st of November. So let's say the debit order was due to go off in, tomorrow, my policy would then renew on the 1st of November. It doesn't happen. By the middle of November, so the 14th, my insurance company must tell me, oh, by the way, you've missed a payment. I'm sure they'll be quicker than that.
Yes.
And then I say, well, yeah, I'm going to pay you. Honestly, I will. And then I don't pay them again on the 1st of December. They've then got to tell me, you haven't paid us, we're going to cancel in 2 weeks' time. That essentially gives me a 6 week grace period, does it?
No.
Okay.
Help me. I'm glad you mentioned that, and maybe my maths is out, but they are required by, in terms of the PPR, the Policyholder Protection Rules, to give you 15 days grace from the due date. Okay, so
this
is the first. Some people is the 25th, say. So your policy cannot lapse in those 15 days. Some insurers, and this is a good point of comparison, some insurers will give you up to 30 days grace, but the minimum is 15, right? But they've also got to tell you, because, you know, it could be just a case that you've switched banks and your bank hasn't, the bank you've gone to hasn't brought all the debit orders over to them as they said they would, and, you know, you think you've paid, but you haven't. But they have to tell you. They can't just, after the 15 days grace, sorry for you, you've heard nothing and your policy has lapsed.
What constitutes in writing? An SMS to say your payment is overdue? Does it have to be a letter through the post, or is it going to be a fax?
No, I think it's probably going to be an SMS. Pretty sure it'll be an SMS. It might be an email, but I think certainly an SMS would constitute in writing. But the last month or so, the Ombudsman for Short-Term Insurance raised a red flag around this and urged policyholders to check what their policies actually state about missed payments, because they vary slightly around what that, you know, that minimum 15-day grace period. And there's certain, this is actually speaks to what you've just asked me. They are silent on how, it doesn't speak to what you've just asked me. It's silent on how payment of the premium should be made within the grace period. So there might be a special plan that the all particular insurers has come up with in terms of their terms and conditions that you have to pay in a certain way or whatever. And if you don't read up on that, you could fall foul of it. But the other thing that they warned about was that a policyholder assumes that the 15-day grace period starts from the date their debit order usually goes off. But the chosen debit day is not always the premium due date, which is always the first of the month. So you need to check on that as well. You could get your timing horribly wrong.
You've got a really interesting case study around this one now, Wendy, because there's a lady called Nolozuko and MyWay Insurance who butted heads recently once she'd butted her car into something, or somebody butted their car into hers.
Yes.
What happened?
Her timing was particularly unfortunate, Bruce. She had a car accident on the 12th of June. The insurer, MyWay, deemed it to be a write-off, which means that the cost of the repairs was estimated to be more than 70% of the retail value of the car. That's when they say we're not repairing. It's a write-off, and then you should get paid out a certain amount that they calculate. MyWay's terms and conditions state I will have 15 days grace from the collection date. On the collection date, see, to make arrangements for the premium to be collected from my chosen bank account. So MyWay repudiated Nolozuko's claim, because when they tried to deduct via debit order her premium on the 25th of May, it was returned unpaid. They then made arrangements to deduct the premium on the 10th of June, which takes you to that 15 days, right? And it was again returned. And so she didn't have cover for from the 20th of May to the 24th of June, and we cannot consider any claims or losses for losses during this period. Now, think about this. Her grace period expired on the 10th of June, Bruce, and the accident happened just 2 days later. So particularly unfortunate. It was hard lockdown. Norizuka was on maternity leave. Her employer confirmed it was that she was on maternity leave. You remember what the Department of Labor was like, complete disarray for all payments. They didn't pay her maternity benefits that she was counting on, hence the missed premium. And on those grounds, the appeal that her sister helped her to lodge with MyWay failed.
So I mean, this is just error after error after error. She, through no fault of her own, she was short of money. It was supposed to come to the department. It didn't happen. But where she was wrong, I suspect, is that she didn't flag this with anybody. Yes, exactly. She's pregnant. Yes, she's pregnant. Yes, she's not necessarily herself. Yes, she's stressed because she's not getting money from the Department of Labor. But MyWay isn't psychic. I mean, they can't tell what's going on in your life.
Yes.
You have an obligation to inform the insurer what your position is.
And the aggravating circumstance was that Norizuka had been a client for 2 years and 4 months, and she was very au fait with the implications of missed premiums because she'd missed 5 payments and 4 attempted resubmissions within the grace period before.
That so doesn't help. Okay, all right.
It didn't help, and so I knew I was pushing it a bit, but I just thought the reality was COVID. The maternity benefits she was entitled to and didn't get, and 2 days, just 2 days after the grace period, and some insurers do give a grace period of longer than 15 days. So I thought it was worth taking up and just seeing if they could reconsider on the grounds of treating customers fairly and all the rest. And I'm happy to say that while MyWay did point out that her big mistake was that she did not keep in touch. She didn't inform them. She didn't give them an opportunity during that grace period to engage with her. That just was just unmet payments. But they said we do feel that we treat that TCF is central to our culture. The rejection of the claim was fair, but we look at it in terms of exceptional circumstances under lockdown. On humanitarian grounds, as they put it, we will give her an ex gratia payment because Norizuka had actually paid for the car to be repaired. She didn't feel she had a choice, and so they are going to be paying out what they would have paid out for the write-off minus salvage value, the missed premium, fair enough, and the excess. So I was happy to be able to share that with her. She had a newborn at the time, and, I just thought, my stress, MyWay was perfectly within its rights to do it, but I just thought it was a good case study to underline the fact that, well, number one, know about your grace period and how it works, how many days you've actually got, and also don't keep quiet, which is a natural reaction for some. Address it full on, inform them, the bank, the insurer, or whatever the credit provider is so much more likely to be accommodating if you just communicate with them.
I think she got very, very lucky to have you on her side, frankly, Wendy. I mean, she's got, unfortunately, a track record of problematic payments. This time, however, exceptional circumstances. I'm not
very
too sure
so.
That they'll entertain this sort of issue again.
I'm sure they won't.
That's our consumer ninja, Wendy Nola, fighting for your consumer rights. Well, on Tuesdays, it's our investment school and donning the mortarboard and the academic gown as headmaster of the money school this week, Mduduzi Luthuli, founder of Luthuli Capital, talking about past performance and why you can never use past performance as a guarantee of the future. An interesting discussion with Mduduzi Luthuli.
Anyone who deeply understands investing understands that investing is not a science, but rather a craft. Because for all the technical analysis, all the numbers, the graphs, the tickers, there's still so much that we don't know and can't know about the future. So even if you're a seasoned investor, you might have high conviction in the stock market's ability to create wealth, to give you above inflation returns. But because we certainly do not know the future, all the past can act as a guide because there's no guarantee that what happened in the past will happen in the future. And that's why we hear this, is that because investing for the numbers, for the technical analysis, is actually more of a craft more craft in it. There's a science.
You're breaking hearts everywhere, Mduduzi, because everyone thinks that, you know, it's actually, it is scientific, it is mathematical. This is something that, you know, we're told, you can do some calculations, you can make some good choices. But I think history has shown us that, I mean, the craft element of it is that, you know, some of the best money managers in the world are as much artists as they are magicians, as they are scientists and mathematicians.
Most definitely. What those numbers really do is that they take what is an infinite number of possibilities and they bring that down to a reasonable window of probability. And really the hard part about investing, it comes down to being able to accurately value an asset. And why that's important is that the value of an asset depends entirely on the net cash it will generate going forward. What will this, if I buy this stock, what will it do for me going forward? Because if you're buying it today, it doesn't really give you much benefit of what it's done previously. This goes for a stock, an investment property, or a business. Past performance doesn't guarantee future performance. An asset only has value in the financial sense if it can generate net cash flow to its owner going forward. And the amount and timing of that cash determines the value of that asset. So what that means is the more cash that you can expect, and the sooner that you can expect that cash to come, the more valuable that asset is today. And this is the fundamental truth about investing. Nothing escapes the orbit of future cash flows. I think that, for me, is the core of when we're talking about investment fundamentals. This is what we're talking about. This is the thing that if you're an investor, you should really be thinking about and talking about and obsessing about more than what the Fed will do, more than what the president said on TV or what the CEO of some company had for breakfast. You need to ask yourself, do you have any reasonable means of actually assessing what the business, which in this case is represented by the stock that you're buying, will earn over the next 5, 10, or 20 years in relation to what it's earning now? And this is, for me, is the most important question to be asking as an investor. And why is that important? Because when you ask this question, it generates some sub-conclusion. It pops up some things that you should be aware of. The first is that what an asset has earned in the past does not determine its value, like I said in the beginning. In stocks, looking at the last 10 years of earnings, it's a useful exercise in trying to understand, well, what type of business is this? Is it profitable and are those profits reliable? So looking at the past is a good exercise in trying to understand what type of business you're dealing with. But while it's a good guide, past earnings do not generate value.
Here's the thing. I mean, every set of financial results we're looking at the moment are reflecting the stuff that's gone down in COVID as far as SOE adverts are going. I mean, we just saw the airports company come out with results today and they're going, well, we made more than $1 billion rands worth of profit. And yeah, well done. That was to the end of March. What about since then? As we came back from January holidays and you came through clogged airports and you resented the queues and the security and, you know, all of the discomfort of commercial travel, suddenly that world has been turned upside down. The past is absolutely no guarantee of the future. So then here is the question for you. How do you better divine the future when the future is impossible, as we've learned this year, to divine? We've always thought we could forecast the future. This year's proven that we can't.
I think the first step is simply just accepting that fact. I see far too many clients who want the benefits of investing, who want the dream, the promised land that this will give you above inflation returns, but they don't want to accept the counter reality that although the probability of getting those investment returns is high, there is no guarantee. Because if you have no idea what an asset will earn in the future, then you have no idea what it's actually worth. And if you don't know what the asset is worth, then you have no idea whether you are overpaying or underpaying for this asset. And if you're an intellectually honest person, you should consider that both possibilities are at least likely. So therein lies the problem, because we've already stated that past performance doesn't guarantee future results. And perhaps let me explain this as an example. When you're investing in uncertain assets, you must accept that this involves some level of of speculation. And why I say that is that if you take a business like Visa, if you take a business like Visa, which has a tremendous amount of money, which is closely related to the amount of money they made last year, their cash flows are based on the number of transactions made on cards and the amount of money they'll collect per transaction. So when you look at these are very stable elements on a day-to-day basis. And that's when you look at a company like Visa, why people love a company like Visa, is that you have a very good understanding of what are the earnings for the next year, for the next 2 years, 3 years, maybe even 5 years. But even a company like that, which has very stable cash flow, it would take a very brave person to estimate what the earnings will be 30 years from now, 20 years from now. And we continuously make the point that investing is for the long term, 10, 20, 30 years. And then you also come with companies like technology companies, which are the most popular. So you look at a company like Twitter. The company made a $1.2 billion profit in 2019, which was its first profitable year since going public in 2013. So literally, if you've been investing in this company since 2013, you've been doing so in hope that it will realize its potential. And therein lies the problem, that if you cannot accurately say what the future earnings are, then you cannot accurately say what the value of this asset is. And the more,
I want to find out how we go about then identifying what the value of a company is, because, I mean, it's so, as you say, it's a craft. It's a matter of opinion often. And so let's get to that. And as Warren Buffett said, this is a rough quote. This isn't precise at all. But he said, you've got to only invest in companies that can be run by an idiot, because at some point in the future, you can bet that the company will be run by an idiot. And so often we see management teams, of course, mess up perfectly good companies. And that happens from time to time. Let's say Steinhoff, pick another one. There are lots of them. We'll pick up on this in a moment with Mduduzi Luthuli at Luthuli Capital.
The Money Show.
Investment School.
With Mduduzi Luthuli this evening, the co-founder and executive director at Luthuli Capital. And again, there is no better person to quote when it comes to investing than Warren Buffett. I apologize for throwing Warren Buffett quotes at you. But there's another one. Price is what you pay. Value is what you get. And I think that's what you're getting to here, Mduduzi Luthuli, in terms of, you know, you can buy a share any day of the week. You can pay any price you like. But, whether you're going to make any money out of that the long term really does depend on your entry price on buying into an investment.
100%, because the bare fact is that an asset must eventually give you some sort of profit. It must eventually generate some sort of net cash flow to its owner, which is commensurate with the price paid for the investment for it to be worthwhile. Meaning that if you're overpaying and if you're paying too much and you don't get that future cash flow, then you never realize the benefit of doing that. So investing on another basis for me is by definition speculation. You know, you must understand the cash flow, because any future cash flow of an asset must then be subtracted in determining today's value. And what that means is that if a business is going to lose money for 10 years, and only then start making money, then it's worth a hell of a lot less than a business which will make the same amount of money, but that will start this year. And for me, this is another idea which surprisingly doesn't get spoken about a lot, because if you have no idea what an asset will earn in future, like I say, then you have no idea what it's worth. In terms of how you do this, you know, there's a reason why people say cash is king. You got to follow the cash flow, and therein comes the science of it. Because unfortunately, even if you're looking at the cash flow, there's several approaches that exist to calculating that cash flow. So when you're performing a comparative analysis between the relative value of similar firms, you will struggle to have a consistent valuation. And it's exactly this why I say that any investment will always tell you that past performance doesn't guarantee future performance. Because even as the investment world, we cannot all agree on a standardized version of valuation and assessing cash flow. And that's why things fall through the cracks.
But that's what makes the market. That's what makes opportunities occur. That's what makes some shares ridiculously expensive, giving opportunity to owners to sell them at stupid prices to people who are not paying attention to the real value of the business. That's what makes the market. That's the magic, isn't it, for those who do understand the process of investing.
Exactly. And you talk about Warren Buffett there. So I'll say something that his partner said, Charlie Munger, who on several occasions has commented that stocks are valued partly like bonds, in that you can look at the obvious cash flow estimated and discounted at rational rates, and partly like art, because why I say that is there's a lot of speculation that goes into the price. And a lot of speculation that the price will go higher or go lower because of popularity, because of trend, because of events like COVID-19. And the riskiest assets are the ones valued primarily on speculation. And that's why when you're buying FANG stocks, you accept that increased level of volatility, because you understand that companies like that are valued primarily on speculation because of our lack of ability to see into the economic future. That's why a corporate bond tends to be less risky than a stock. You only need to establish that the corporation will be solvent for the bond to be a good investment. Whereas with a stock, you must make very complicated estimates. And that's why I think this is a pushback against things like market efficiency, because for as long as there's human beings running the stock market, and with all the algorithms and all the numbers, it's still human beings buying and selling stocks. And it's that simple factor that there will be mispricing in the stock market, and that there will be opportunities to buy good assets that are undervalued. But like I said, the trick is trying to have an accurate valuation system that is repeatable, and that is the key to investing. You
know? Is that possible?
It's possible, but I don't think it's 100% doable. Because if it was 100% doable, then I think we'd all be millionaires. So like I said earlier, all that valuation does is that it takes an infinite number of possibilities and then just puts them to maybe 5 to 10 probabilities. And even then, it's not a guarantee. It's just, look, I'm in the ballpark and I'm taking a very educated guess. Hence, I say that investing is more craft than science, because for all the numbers, for all the valuations and anything that goes into it, there is no guarantee as to what the future will hold.
How do we minimize the risk we take when we make an investment? How do we ensure that we have the best possible chance of success?
The best possible chance of success is either speaking to an investment professional, or I know a lot of people say, Dr. push back on that. But I always say this to people, is that if you're not going to take the time to become financially literate, to dedicate yourself to understanding the investment world, which is why people do it as their profession, then you're no different to someone who is gambling. Because how do you bring more certainty? That comes to having an investment plan. What is an investment plan? An investment plan at its core is simply a risk management plan. It's trying to assess, what are the risks that exist with this investment, and what can I do today to prepare for those risks or minimize the potential outcomes of those risks if they are realized? And that's what investing is. It is the business of risk management, because you are putting money into an uncertain future. And that's why I say, as an investor, at your core, you have to be an optimist, because if you don't believe that the future will be better than today, then why would you ever invest?
But that is the point. I mean, and again, history shows us, and I know that, you know, past performance is no guarantee of future performance. I know this. Yes. But history teaches us that humanity moves forward and progresses. Generally speaking, there are times where we make a terrible mess of it, like we are at the moment. But somehow we sort of pull ourselves right and we get back on track.
Mm. I think the biggest problem is that the bad news is always top of mind, and it's constant, and it's what we hear every single day. But the good news, the good things that are happening in the world that prove that the world is progressing.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking. Get your copy of the Africa Financial Markets Index Report at cib.absa.africa and explore Africa's possibility in detail. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
Mduduzi Lutuli, the founder of Lutuli Capital, at our investment school on Tuesday nights. We do it every Tuesday at 7:30. Then, after making all the money we can possibly do, we then get very nosy about other people's money. What a fabulous discussion we had with the actor and director Tony Joroge, best known for his roles in Invictus, Blood Diamond, Hotel Rwanda, and of course ETV's soapy Mbewu as well. I asked him whether he had a favourite movie role.
I really like Long Walk to Freedom because of, you know, moving from the young to the old into the very, very old. Like, you know, I was playing Walter Sisulu when he was young in his 30s, and I got to play him when he was like in his 60s, and when he was very old, like in his late 70s to the 80s. So it's always a nice thing to play a character like that.
But kind of weird to play an icon too. I mean, especially one whose family is still around and whose family is very active and very active in the memory of Walter Sisulu as well. Did you go and spend some time with the Sisulus and just sort of say, okay, tell me about this guy. Tell me what the history books don't tell us. Tell me about his personality. His, you know, what was he like in private?
Yes. No, I did. I had a chance with me and my wife to go visit the family. Then they cooked for us and we sat down. We saw the grandkids, the Shaka was there as well, I remember. Mm-hmm. And we spent time with them, you know, and that was all I was interested in trying to understand what kind of a father was he. Was he strict? Was he nice? Was he always teaching you guys politics? Or was he a father when he was home and he was talking politics? You know, all those kind of things are the things that I was trying to find out in terms of me trying to play. And the hardest thing, actually, to play... My fear, my greatest fear was that he was still so clear in people's memories.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I was battling with, it was that, you know, Walter was a light-skinned guy. And here's Tony, as dark as ever, coming to play this light-skinned guy. And I'm like, people are not going to believe me. They're not going to believe anything that I do. But hey, you know, at least I got through it. And the director was very nice. And the support that I got from the family and the support that I got also from the cast was tremendous. So I was able to push through and make sure that at least I enter into his spirit and portray him like, I try to do on Long Walk.
He was an extraordinary activist. I mean, his role in sort of the pre-Rivonia trial days, and he crisscrossed the country. He visited so many areas of the country under huge personal duress and safety constraints. I mean, I think a remarkable individual. I never had the privilege of meeting him personally, but wow. I mean, you read the stories of Walter Sisulu, and he was a remarkable individual. What are you up to now? I mean, there haven't been any big movies, but you've done quite a few series.
Yes, I have. I've been trying. I'm trying to do some Netflix movies right now, but obviously due to COVID problems that we're going through, and cast members testing positive and crew members testing positive, we have to stop the shooting and so on and so forth. So that's been the ups and downs for the past 6 months. Actually, we haven't been able to do anything.
Are you allowed to tell us what you're working on? I mean, are you on a Netflix project as we speak?
Yes, it's actually a nice, very fun project. It's called Jaiva.
Can you tell us about it?
Yes, it's about dance. It's about these young kids coming up, all these new urban culture that is rising, of people dancing, coming up with new moves, competing, and all that. And within that, you know, there's a story of obviously family linked to it. And it's a very basic plot, but it has very beautiful nuances in them of interactions of families, emotions of young kids fighting with their parents, and parents thinking that, what is this dancing thing? You cannot do this thing. It's stupid. Stop it. And then, you know, so back and forth, one of those things. It's a very a light a series, but very, 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 very energetic.
Tell me about Netflix and Netflix's role. And we're just seeing Netflix play such an important role in terms of allowing artists and allowing directors to create African content for global markets. And it's a wonderful innovation. You're not going to say anything horrible about Netflix, but you know, one always worries about was a cultural imperialism and the mighty Netflix, and you know, they're going to grab control of global agendas and global minds. But they seem to be very open to locals telling their own stories for global distribution. It seems like quite a nice model, at least so far.
Yes, I think it's a wonderful thing what Netflix is doing, and I don't think they're putting too much stress on the creatives or the writers of the series to say, you know, this is how you must write or write this way, and so because they give you the freedom to do whatever it is that you want to do without putting you in confined spaces. The only thing that I always raise with them is like, how come you give, let's say, the Brazil Netflix certain budget, and for us it becomes different from theirs? Why are you giving? So I will compare all the third worlds. Say, okay, if it's a third world thing, then why is that third world getting more budget than us? Why is that one getting, you know? So it's just little things that maybe, I don't know what it is. I don't know whether it's how our industry has accepted Netflix and the people who are trying to help in terms of service. The production services that are working with Netflix to say, no, in South Africa, this is how we work. Oh, this is how we pay, you know. So it's one of those things that we don't really know yet, but we are hoping that maybe Netflix will look into it and say, hey, let's try to big up something here.
And I suppose it becomes, how much global interest is there in South African stories? For so long, the South African story was about Mandela. There always had to be a Mandela connection. And I think as we move on, we have to tell authentic African stories, South African stories. And people are captivated by the samba, by Brazilian culture. If we start telling South African stories really well, there's bound to be greater demand for them, and when there's demand, the budgets will follow. Is that naive? I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's not naive at all. I think it's true. And also maybe it's also to encourage our, because what happens is that sometimes our writers or our creatives, they tend to fall into other cultures, you know, because, you know, again, our South African culture is getting so diluted. So they tend to forget the roots of who they are and try to copy the others. And they do a bad imitation of others instead of creating who they are and just taking it out to the world.
Yeah, I mean, we're not telling our own stories. We sort of tell Americanized versions of our stories, because I think so much of our television, we've all grown up with American television, sort of, you know, the American comedies, the American sitcoms. And it's great.
It's true.
But you don't get a sense of identity. You don't get a sense of belonging. You don't get a sense of you're representing a culture. Talk to me about money. Are you good with money? Because this is why we're here.
No, I'm not good with money.
I mean,
I'm okay.
Define okay.
Yes, I'm okay. Okay, meaning that I can kind of like budget and follow up on it. And sometimes I fall off, and sometimes I will overspend. Sometimes I will not plan properly and it catches up with me sometime. And due to the nature of the industry that I'm in, it also gets you, you know, all over the place in terms of your planning and stuff like that. So it kind of like makes me not be on track properly with money.
But it's hard when you're gigging, though, isn't it? I mean, it's hard when you might have one or two projects in the pipeline, but there's nothing after that.
So
there's nothing for June next year. So you start worrying about June next year. Do you put money aside? Do you try and stretch your money, or do you work on the basis that, you know what, I'm good at this. I've been in good movies. I've had good roles. I'm a good-looking guy. Yeah. I can act. I can string a sentence together. I can direct. Some of the gigs will come. How do you operate?
I mostly operate I work with my agent very closely, and who is the person who will then understand that to say, okay, fine, Tony, we've got three scripts lined up. This one is good, this one is bad, this one is whatever. And I'll be like, okay, fine, I own my car. First, I'll have to think of the problems that I'm in. They say, okay, fine, I need to get rid of this. I need to get to make sure that the kids' schools are paid, the car is okay, the house is fine. And then start saying, okay, let's look at maybe June next year. Let's look if I can be able to, these three scripts that I have will be able to carry me until whatever time. And then it will come to the fact saying that, but if you use this for all your problems, then that means that you're not going to see June next year. You're only going to see December. Then I'll then have to think of other things that I do, whether I venture into directing or help my wife with her fashion lines and creative cool stuff, you know?
But, and that's all kind of good when it feels a bit normal. But the last 6 months have really disrupted any performer's life, comedians, actors, musicians, everybody.
Everybody is just, you know, it's so bad in the industry that even the little bit that the government was trying to do in trying to for the relief fund and stuff like that, it was like it created more trouble than helping, you know. But it's just a situation of how the new norm is now, I think.
We're chatting this evening to Tony Joroge, who's the actor and director. He's had lots of movies, lots of series. And we're talking to him about money, how he grew up with money, what informs him about money, and the fact that he's okay with it. We'll get on to him more in a moment.
The Money Show.
Other people's money.
That other person is Tony Joroge, the actor this evening. When you told your parents, I'm going to become an actor, did they not talk to you for a month? Were they worried about you? Did they wonder how on earth you were going to make it? Or did they just know that you were going to be successful?
No, my parents didn't really want me to go into this acting. They just thought I'm crazy and I want to play around with my life and I'm not serious. I must just think of being a lawyer. But that was my dad mostly. So my dad wanted me to be a lawyer. And then my mom was like, you know, just like any other mom, like, no, let him try it out and we'll see what happens. And, you know, I got myself into, and the nice thing was that I was very lucky because I got a bursary to go study. And the bursary was given by Odemiester. So they paid for all my school fees. So they didn't even feel the heaviness of the tuitions that I'm feeling right now.
How old are your kids?
I have how old is Ketlev? 24? It's 24-year-old, 19-year-old, 14-year-old, and a 10-year-old.
That's many more years of big expenses coming your way.
Yes, sir.
How have you planned for them? Are you a planner or do you fly by the seat of your pants?
I plan and somehow I fall along the wayside and I get up again and I try to plan and you know, like it also goes back to that whole thing of our industry being the way it is. I've got in so much trouble with these private schools, you know, them trying to kick the kid out and stuff like that. But, you know, we try to maintain and keep it together, at least for the kids to have a good schooling. And, you know, we also, the lucky thing is like, you know, it's me and my, since if my wife is working, sometimes I'm not working, if I'm working, sometimes it's not working. So we kind of like balance each other and plan together in trying to make everything work.
I think more and more today couples are a lot more open about their finances. I think it's quite an old school approach where the man would take care of the finances and he would end up dying long before she would, and she would realize that he had a gambling problem or had another family, whatever the case is. And actually the house's personal finances were in complete disarray and there was chaos. Do you have a collaborative approach with your wife? Do you work together?
Yes, we do. We really work together because we also understand the industry and we're in the industry together. So we really try to help and hold hands in every little thing, every step that we take when it comes to the financial matters.
What's been your best financial decision ever? As an actor, have you taken out insurance policies? Have you bought bits of art? Have you invested in, I don't know, did you invest in Trevor Noah when you first met him, if you did? what have been your best money decisions?
It was for us to buy a house that we were comfortable with, that we could, because we were coming from, you know, like townhouses, and in us saving and making sure that at least we have a decent house where we can be able to live comfortably with our kids and take them to what we call good schools. That was my the best decision that I've ever made. And yes, in terms of, you know, taking out policies and stuff like that, we try, but then when it's dry in the industry, sure, you know, those policies collapse.